Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Well, let's go. Let's see what the hell happens here.
Cracking my knuckles.
Hey, everybody, it's Kai Rizdahl.
I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart. Kai is cracking his knuckles settling in.
I should have done it closer to the microphone, actually. Let me just say at the get-go here that I've got a throat lozenge in my mouth, so if it sounds weird, that's why. I'm just saying. It's either that or me sounding like this, and I don't want to do that. Because, as we know, I was sick last week. I had strep, and I had a big boogery cold on top of that, and I was. That's why Molly was all by herself. I'm just saying.
Aww, yeah,
so I'm better now, except I got a little thing going on, and I'm just taking preventative measures. That's all I'm saying. All right, so
that seems wise.
What are we doing this week?
We're doing it all. As opposed to, we are really, like, so many things are happening first thing on a Monday. Pew-pew! That's my laser productivity sound that I make when lots of things are going on all at the same time. This week, we are bringing back the Explain-a-thon.
Yes, we are.
Where we are going to laser shoot down all your questions. But in the form of answering.
Yes.
Not shooting down like that was not smart. No. We will try to answer as many questions as we can reasonably do from you in this episode. However, this is the part where we note we haven't seen them yet. Most of you sent voice memos to us, so we get to play your answers and then try to answer them. We are also, and this is so exciting, going to have listeners on the line live to talk to.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And then my understanding is that Kai and I are going to deliver our answers to the Make Me Smart questions.
Didn't we do that on the Reddit AMA the other day? By the way, go check out our Reddit AMA. You should, because it was good.
No, but now we have to read them, just in case people miss it. We're going to tell you what we said on the Reddit AMA, which you should go see, by the way, because there is, like, even after it ended, such smart conversation happening on the Reddit AMA page. It's amazing.
Although, well, I've thought about that when we get there. But anyway, so look, here's the deal, though. We don't know everything because the name of the game on this show is that all y'all help us know stuff. So there will be things that I'm sure, and let me say this one more time, we have not seen these questions yet, that we don't know. And when that does happen, we're going to do a thing that we call Pass to Tony, which is the guy who does all of our digital stuff. And it's going to sound like this when we say, help, Tony. So that's how you're going to know that we're that's how you're going to know we're punting. We could call that the Kai and Molly punt sign, too. That we could do that.
Yep.
Yep.
But, yeah, that means Tony will look it up and he will answer put an answer post on makemesmart.org, which is almost like a Reddit AMA, but in delayed time.
Oh, yeah. True.
Kai, you're just breaking my heart.
What?
Honey, you sound so sick.
I know. I'm. You know what's really funny? I sound so much better than I did a week ago.
It's
by
terrible.
The way, I'm getting on a plane again tomorrow, so, you know, I'm going to get sicker.
What?
Yeah.
So just when you send him some chicken soup, just wait a couple days, because apparently he'll be on the road. All right, first question. Let's stop feeling sorry for Kai. Eric and Marina Pearsall, two of them, left us this voice memo.
All right.
Hi, Molly and Kai. My spouse and I were talking, and the topic of esports came up. Video game players who receive sponsorships and play games professionally, like a traditional sports team. The words, that would make a great Make Me Smart topic, may have been uttered. Since it deals with both technology and money, we thought it landed squarely in your interests. So without further ado, please help make us smart about esports. Is it profitable? How many people are involved? When did it start becoming a thing? Thanks for listening. Eric and Marina.
Wow. All right. So I could wing some stuff here, or you could start.
I'm furiously duck-duck-going over here just so that I could have some actual numbers for you. But what I can tell you is, yeah, esports make a lot of money. Okay, here we go. The global esports market generated $325 million of revenue in 2015. This is per Wikipedia and its various sources. It was expected to make $493 million in 2016. You know it's a big deal because Amazon spent whatever it spent on Twitch, right? Which was...
Right.
I don't know, in the billions.
So that was going to be part of my answer. Tell people what Twitch is, because that's the important part.
Yes. Twitch is the live streaming game portal. I mean, you could live stream anything on Twitch and people do, but what it is mostly, yeah, the vast majority of its use is for live streaming other people playing video games. That kind of then morphed into tournaments, like a whole bunch of people playing at the same time and it being really competitive. And then that has slowly over the years become this big live stream tournament thing. But people go in person. Like there was a big Overwatch tournament in San Francisco. They're selling out arenas.
Well, they are building purpose-built esports stadiums. The guy who just bought the Los Angeles Times, Patrick Soon-Shiong, is going to build out near the beach here in L.A. He's going to build a venue for exactly that. So, you know, you get gate admissions, you get advertising, you get seat licenses, you get all of that stuff. So it's totally real. It's totally profitable. And my guess is, if it's not already, it will be soon a $1 billion-a-year industry or more. That's
oh, unquestionably. Yeah. We probably should. You're probably right in that this is a great Make Me Smart topic because it is super fascinating. Apparently, the Olympic Committee has looked into incorporating esports. I know. Tell us what you think. Is it a sport or is it not a sport?
Yeah, no, that's a fair one. That's a fair one.
And there's so much that's interesting about it. Like, apparently, these athletes, the esports athletes, after 25 years old, they're done. Like, the fast twitch reflexes are just gone. Yep. I mean, it is the most short-lived career.
And then what do you do? Like all washed up.
Apparently a bunch of them become, like, Wall Street hires them to become day traders. Because even though they're fast Twitch
what
reflexes.
What could possibly go wrong?
Right.
I'm just
seriously
saying. All right.
Just consider that. But they're so fast.
Yeah. No, it makes sense.
That they're just like click, 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 click.
All right,
fascinating.
So that's esports. Do actually write in and tell us, is it a sport or is it not? And let us know what you think. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Question number two, Pat Port lives in San Francisco and wants to know a little more about this.
My question is about fines. So many fines levied on so many corporations by so many government agencies. Where does this money go? And who actually pays these fines? Come on, make me smart.
Well, so either the companies pay them or the insurance companies of the companies pay them, right? That sort of is a sort of an in-house kind of thing. But fundamentally, most of those fines go to one of like three or four places. One is the U.S. Treasury to be parceled out to various agencies to be spent as amelioration for the offense, like a lot of housing fines and mortgage fraud fines paid during the financial crisis went to mortgage and housing agencies in the government to build and create new devices to protect consumers. Some of it goes straight to homeowners or those aggrieved parties. Some of it also goes to states, right? States are sometimes party to these settlements. And they wind up getting a whole bunch of money as well. The tobacco settlement was a big one for that, which is now, my God, 20 years ago. But yeah, so that's the way that works.
And it does seem like it partly depends on who levies the fine.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
The U.S. Treasury might get civil penalties, but if it comes from the U.S. Department of Transportation, which penalized airlines back in 2010, then it might get parceled out. So a big answer to that question is where the fine came from in the first place.
Right.
But it sounds like it goes lots of places. Yeah. It doesn't go to some like magical fund that makes everything right for consumers in case that's what you were hoping.
No, it doesn't. Nope.
Diane Hooker from Omaha, Nebraska. I used to live there. Left us this voice memo about the changing economy.
A lot of people, including me, at many income levels have found work on a contract basis. What kind of effect does the increase in contract work have on the official employment metrics?
So the official employment metrics come in two forms. As we all know, they come out on the first Friday of every month. There is the household survey in which the Department of Labor calls a rotating pool. It's a rotating over time, right? So they drop some people 1 month and then pick up new people the following month. So it's a continuous sample. And they call them and say, hey, did you find a job? Are you employed? And then you give them the answer to the question. And then the other survey is what's called the employment survey, where they call companies and say, hey, did you create any jobs? And that's where you get the number of jobs added thing that you hear me say the first Friday of every month. So if you have a contract job and you answer when the Labor Department calls and say, yeah, I got a job, then you're counted as having a job. And if you say, well, I'm working part-time, then you go in a different category of part-time. So it there are a lot of variables in there, but that's where the data comes from, and that's how it's represented. And if you really want to know more, BLS.gov, BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, can break down the unemployment report for you about 19,000 different ways. And there's all kinds of good data in there.
We should note, too, that in June of this year, the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, actually gave its first report on gig economy work specifically. Yeah. So yep. slightly separate from contract, but the idea of what they called, contingent or alternative yeah. work. And so they did in fact try to make a first specific shot, take a shot at measuring that specifically. Right. And they said it was something like 16.5 million people are yeah. currently working in quote contingent or alternative work arrangements, which is like, you know, renting out your house to Airbnb.
All right. Here comes one on, it's sort of tech and economy combined, I think.
Hello, Molly and Kai. This is Jonathan Cook, and I was just thinking about AI trading on the stock market. I was listening to Marketplace Tech recently, and they said that the majority of trading right now is being done by those AIs. Those AIs suppress volatility on the market, though, and volatility is very profitable because, you know, it's easier to buy low and sell high and make money. So it occurred to me that somebody might come along and create a predatory AI to do this. So my questions to you guys are, has this been thought of? Has anybody tried it? And is it necessarily legal since you're intentionally crashing the market?
Another entry in the what could possibly go wrong files.
No, seriously. I want to know more about the assertion that automated trading systems reduce volatility.
Yeah, so I think it's important to differentiate between what we have now, which is automated trading systems working on algorithmic basis, right, versus mm-hmm. AI, which is learning and thinking and then applying that to what's going on, right? Because yep. algorithmic trading does not suppress volatility, right? And a case can be made that actually once things start going downhill or uphill, they make it worse. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a little bit of apples and oranges there.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, the question of whether somebody could come along and create a predatory AI to either, you know, take massive advantage of the stock market or crash it,
yeah.
I people already have to some extent, right? Like there's no question that if there is gain to be had, people are going to try to use these algorithms yes. to reap more gain, and there will be varying degrees of legality applied. But it's important to know that this is a huge part of, I think it's something like only 40% of trading now is considered active investment. Like machines are doing the vast majority of trading on Wall Street right now. And so people argue that dark pools alone are predatory algorithms. So, yeah, they're here. Can you intentionally legally crash the market?
Don't do that.
I don't think so, but
somebody will come and find you if you do that.
Somebody will come and find you. That's right. Very true. Yes. All right. This one's from Alan Levy from Claremont, New Hampshire.
Why is it that gasoline and other fuels are the only products that we regularly buy that are priced to the tenth of a cent? Thanks.
I'm just going to say let's hit that pass the Tony button right now.
No, look, there's a link.
I know
apparently
there's a link.
Apparently we actually did a story. But
yeah, okay, fine. Right,
I mean, fine. Yes.
We're
passing to Tony.
I don't know.
Well, what Tony's going to do is put up a post that links to the story we did because we got that as an I've Always Wondered, which is a segment on Marketplace, and we answered why they end in a nine-tenth of a cent. It's like a really long article about why that happens, so we're going to link to it. And
there
then
you're
going to read it. But no, Alan, you're not the only person who wonders.
Next up, Diana McCullough from Columbus, Ohio. Here's her message.
A couple of weeks ago, it was Constitution Day. And so I read my copy and I noticed that it's Congress's responsibility to set taxes, excises, duties, etc. And so I'm wondering, if tariffs are a tax, why does the president set them? Thanks, guys. I appreciate all you do.
Boy, how much time you have? How much time do you have?
This is a fun one.
So look, here's the way this goes. Yes, Congress has that responsibility. But what Congress has done over the past 50 years, literally, as you will see in a minute, it's actually more than 50 years, has given to the president authority to set tariffs, also known as import taxes, in certain very specific cases, mostly having to do with national security. So the ones that the president has put into place in the last 6 months break down into two categories. One is what are known as Section 232 tariffs, which is Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962 as amended. The other one is Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, also as amended. And what those two clauses did was give the president authority to act in the interest of national security in imposing tariffs and taxes. And if you remember back when all of this started, the steel and aluminum tariffs, the thing that came out of the White House was we have to have a strong steel industry in order to protect our national security. Now, I'm not going to parse that here, but that's the rationale that they gave. And that is how Congress now has given to the president over the past 56 years the authority to do this. There is a move in Congress to try to claw back some of that power. The catch, of course, is that under a separate part of the Constitution, if a Congress passes a bill, the president has to sign it. And I defy you to find me a president who's going to sign a bill that voluntarily limits his or her power. End of
sermon.
Wow.
Also, just a slight expansion there. It's way more than 50 years. And if you go all the way back to the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917, which lets the president invoke unlimited tariffs during a time of war, America does not have to be at war with a particular nation. I'm reading from an article on Quora that someone posted on Quora. It just has to be at war. And in 1971, fun fact, President Richard Nixon used this act to impose a 10% import tariff, not directed at any particular nation, citing the Korean War, which had ended nearly two decades prior. Because technically we were still in a state of emergency that had not been lifted.
Learn something new every day. There you go.
I know. I love the internet.
Yes.
All right. It is possible, as you listen to this, that more questions have been raised or that it reminded you of questions you might have about tech and the economy. Please still send them to us. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org or tweet us at Kai Rizdahl and at Molly Wood. We're going to take a short break and then we'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, my turn, and I got it right. We are back with the Explainathon. We have live callers now on the phone who have more questions for us. First one is Jack Kaplan. Hey, Jack.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, good. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Houston, Texas.
Excellent, excellent. All right.
Kai's so good at this live caller thing.
Don't think, just talk. What's your favorite public radio station? No, I'm just kidding. Don't answer that question. all right. So, Jack, what's your question? What do you got?
My question is about what makes someone a publisher versus a platform, and what are the implications that come from being each one? So, like, if technology firms such as Google, Twitter, and Facebook become publishers, would they have an obligation to vet every post before it can be made public on its website?
That is a big fat can of worms right there. Molly Wood, you're up.
I love this question because... because this is the thing that, I mean, if I had a drinking game that was not GDPR, it would be publisher versus platform, because this is, in fact, the kind of central conversation that we're having right now about these technology firms. So the legal answer to your question about what makes someone a publisher versus a platform is Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act. That said, if you are a website that allows other people to contribute information, right? So if you are a Prodigy, like the early internet service provider, or if you're Twitter, you are not legally responsible for what people post there. And Section 230 is the reason that we have the internet economy that we have now, the digital economy we have now, because Google could not exist if it got sued every single time that something showed up in a Google search result that violated some kind of copyright or was defamatory, or, you know, you can imagine all of the ways that that would go. The same with Facebook, the same with Twitter, the same with Reddit. Any site that hosts information that it does not that it doesn't create, is considered a platform, and it's legally free in some ways. You're not allowed to host illegal content. Like, there are restrictions, but Section 230 is essentially what allows that to happen. These days, the waters are getting much muddier, partly because we're worried about the power of all these platforms, but also because a lot of them are, you know, Google is significantly impacting the way that information is presented through Google News or through ads or by prioritizing its own services in search results. And that muddies the water. Facebook is spending a ton of money to build an original content video platform. And so it is arguably a publisher. And none of them want to be a publisher because, yes, to answer the second part of your question, if they are considered a publisher the way the New York Times is, or Marketplace, something that, you know, a site that we have rules, lots of rules about to the extent to which we have to vet our content before it can be made public.
So bearing in mind, Ms. Wood, that the Congress of the United States cannot find its backside with both hands, do you think, even given what's going on today with Facebook and the elections and all of that, is there a real movement to amend this, or is it not real?
Well, there was an amendment pretty recently. So the first kind of dent in Section 230 was recently passed, and it was an act that made sites criminally liable if they host information related to sex trafficking. Mm-hmm. And a lot of, you know, there were plenty of internet scholars who said, look, these rules already exist, right? Section 230 already says you can't host illegal content. And to make this very specific carve out for sex trafficking is just sort of confusing, because it's like, how is that more illegal than other content? But it was the first effort in what I think will be a couple of piecemeal efforts to come at Section 230. It came up a lot. It's really, really wonky, and so it's just going by really fast, but it's come up a bunch of times in hearings recently. And so I think if it becomes something people tie to, like, partisan speech, because there's concern about suppressing conservative voices on some of these platforms, I wouldn't be surprised if what you see are individual carve-outs like that, as opposed to one big, like, get rid of Section 230. But it's really significant, because so much money is at stake and such big companies are at stake. And I'm glad you asked that question, because I think it's just going to be a huge conversation going forward.
Jack, did we hook you up?
Yes, sir.
All right, man. Thanks for calling.
More than you even wanted, probably. Yeah. Thank you.
All right. See you, Jack. Be good. All right. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much.
Our next caller is Becca Weinberg from Chicago. Do we have her on the line?
Yes, you do. Hi, Molly and Kai.
Becca.
Hey, Becca.
Hello.
What's up? How's the weather? How's the weather in Chicago?
It's actually beautiful today.
Oh, nice. Good.
Yeah.
I love Chicago.
Yeah, the leaves are just starting to change on the lake.
There you go.
Ugh. See, that's what I love about it. All right, hit us. Tell us what your question is.
All right, I've been enjoying the podcast so much, and I'm thinking a lot about technology kind of in all aspects of my life. This year, my son is in fourth grade. This is the first time they're using Chromebooks and Google Classrooms. Oh, yeah. And I can't help but wonder, what is Google doing with all that data? You know, I've heard iterations of you aren't the consumer, you're the product. And I looked that up. Apparently, it goes back to 1973. But how freaked out should I be? Is my kid the product?
Hmm. You know, I need to do a story about this, actually. This is like a pass to Molly, because I completely agree. Like, my kid is using all these Google products, and they created a Gmail account for him.
Yep,
and he's got this email address, and he's just logging in, and they're just like, yeah, we just went ahead and made you an email address. And I'm like, wait, didn't you also just make a data trail for my child, and you didn't get my explicit permission as a parent? And it feels like kind of a big deal. And I completely agree with you, and I don't know what the agreements are between schools and Google, and I would like to find out. And I think that is a great story idea.
There you go.
Because I agree. As a parent, I agree. I'm like, wait, what?
So the answer to that one is we don't know, but we'll find out. So keep listening.
Yeah.
And Molly will do the story. Probably put it on
totally.
Tech, and we'll bring it here too.
Thank you for the story idea.
All right. Thanks, Becca.
All right, thanks.
See ya. Bye-bye.
See ya. Bye. Bye.
All right, Sarah Grollo has this question about tax cuts and tariffs. Sarah, are you there?
Yes, hi.
Hey, Sarah, it's Kai Rizdahl. How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, good. Thanks for taking the time to chat with us.
Thank you.
All right, so hit us up with your question.
So my question is, I'm a financial planner, and I work with a lot of small business owners who are going to be directly impacted by the new tariffs. So we've been trying to figure out if the new tax law with the qualified deduction, the new rules for depreciation, and the lower rates would offset the cost of the tariffs to them. And in doing some research, there's a lot of different points of view and calculations on this, and it seems to have to do with how long the time horizon used in the calculations is. And so we're trying to figure out if this is really going to be long-term a good thing or not.
Well, so look, it's literally all about the time horizon. You fundamentally are asking the right question, but here is the problem with thinking about the time horizon for this one, right? The time horizon of the tax cuts, we know about. It's statutory. It's in there. There are certain things that are expiring. There are certain things that won't. Yes, Congress is going to come in and mess with it, and that's fine. But there is a, I can't believe I'm saying this about the Congress. There is some certainty around the tax code. The catch, of course, with the trade and tariffs and all of that that's going on, as I was just explaining earlier, is that the president is doing this of and by himself, and we don't know what the time horizon for the trade war and the tariffs is. There is no sign right now that either the Chinese, just to pick one big part of this, there's no sign right now that the Chinese are thinking about backing out, they're backing down. There's certainly no sign that the White House and Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross and the president are thinking about backing down, and so we don't know. This could all somehow magically be fixed tomorrow if Steven Mnuchin gets on a plane and Xi Jinping says, ah, yes, thank you for coming, everything's fine. That's probably not going to happen, but it might. So we just don't really know. We can't possibly know because the president is doing this on his executive authority, which is a depressing answer, I know.
Which is not helpful, we understand, for you professionally.
I mean, but does that make sense, right? Because it's literally what the president wants to do, and he's the guy who gets to decide.
Yeah, it's crazy that other people are at this sort of juncture where they can't plan because we don't know.
You bet. Mm-hmm. You bet. And I get that that didn't make you much smarter, but that's the reality. So, you know, you got to roll the dice, which is not a helpful answer for a financial planner to give, I suppose.
Right. But thank you. It makes me feel like we're asking.
Yeah.
It does. Sort of. It's, sometimes it's just validating to know that, in fact, this is not normal.
Right.
So, yeah, there's that.
Which is what we've been saying. Sarah, thanks a lot. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. And to everybody who called in live, how delightful. That is just such a wonderful thing to have on the show. All right, and now, this is big, you guys. This is big. It's time for the Make Me Smart question.
Okay, can I just say, I swear we did this a year ago.
I think we did, but our answers totally changed. Or did our they? Answers,
well, now somebody, we're going to have to check, right? Sarah, check, and we'll have Tony put it online. Let's hit that Tony sound. Yes, we're going to pass that answer to Tony. Tony's going to figure it out.
We are.
And he's going to put it up on the website.
Because I want to know if they're the same. Because we did, in a previous Explain-a-thon, we were also forced to answer the Make Me Smart question. I don't know why we just, it's a hard question, turns out. I don't know why we make people suffer through this all the time. But this Explain-a-thon is essentially a coda, a postscript, if you will, to our Ask Me Anything session on Reddit. Where you asked us so many delightful questions. We had such a good conversation. There were questions about the financial crisis and dream interviews and how we prepare for things and so many questions about beer.
A lot of questions about beer, which is good.
Really a lot. I was like, you know what? I didn't see that many questions about pumpkin spice related
things.
There
were not
really
many pumpkin spice questions. There were not many bourbon questions for you, right? I mean, yeah.
I know, yeah.
So anyway.
But it was fantastic and super interesting. And then everybody was like, you have to answer the Make Me Smart question.
Right. A lot of you said you got to answer the Make Me Smart question. Wince, once again, is what is something you thought you knew, but then you found out you were wrong about? And now, again, we are being forced to do this. And we were forced to answer it by Tony Wagner in the AMA. And so I did and whatever. And let me just say, in preface and defense of my answer, I was having a bad day. It was a little grim. Life was a little bleak.
Aww.
And so here was my answer last, whatever it was, Thursday. I always thought there were consequences, that when you did something wrong or bad or not okay, you'd pay a price. I'm less sure now. I know.
It was
sorry.
A pretty...
I feel there was a certain bleakness.
I feel like on our show, it would be useful to have a dark place sting. Like just a little.
And I'm the only guy who gets played for, right? Come on.
Yeah, we need a little sound effect that we can play after. Like, I feel like the engineer should just take, just feel free to just insert it, like live.
Anywhere, right.
Kai said a dark place thing. Anyway, that was a very, although.
Look, I'm not wrong. Yeah. I'm not wrong.
I'm not sure I can completely disagree. Well, I think we may be redefining wrong or bad or not okay in some ways.
All right. I did mine. You do yours.
Mine was, I wonder what I said. I barely even remember this. Huh. I thought, this is fascinating. I said, I thought that someone out there had the plan. Like, I thought there must be someone smarter than me who had a list in their head of all the right things you were supposed to do in life that produced the optimum outcome. And then maybe that person would come along and take care of me or at least tell me what to do. And then I realized that, nope, no one has a plan. No one can give me all the answers, although some people can give me some of the answers. And for the most part, I am going to have to do things for myself. And at first, and frankly, for a long time, I resented that. And then I eventually realized it was super freeing because I'm in charge and nobody else has some plan that's better than mine. And if I'm in charge, that's just how I like it.
So, you know, what's funny. I think your answer is really close to the one you gave a year plus ago. I think mine is different. But I don't know.
Is it? I think yours is pretty similar too, actually.
Oh God.
I don't
know.
All
right, well, I guess we're going to find out, right?
I know. I'm so curious. I can't wait I can't wait to see what Tony and the gang come back with.
all right. So that's it. That is our explain-a-thon. We'll do another one, you know, eventually because they're fun.
Sometime.
Enjoy them. Anyway. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Back to you guys now for the Make Me Smart answers. So send them to us, right? Remember, the question is, what is something you thought you knew, but you found out you were wrong about? Also, here's the plug for the Reddit AMA. It's on the IAMA subreddit. Lots of interesting stuff in there, and some really good questions, I thought. So there you go. That's the name of the game. Name of the game.
We're so lucky to have such a smart audience, you guys. Nobody trolled us. Make Me Smart is produced by Shara Morris. Our senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer, and he gets all the props for making that AMA happen.
Yeah, totally.
It was fantastic. Thank you, Tony. This week's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. Our theme music is composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. So there you go. I was about to say, I'm Kyle Rizzo. Have a good day, everybody, but I didn't.
Have a good day, everybody.
Have a good day, everybody.
Now it's time to dance.
No dancing. Jesus.
I'm dancing. I'm dancing with the upper part of my body because the lower part of my body is too sore.
Oh, big hike, right? Big hike the other
day? Big backpacking trip, three-day trip.
Good job.
All right, Ow.
Ow.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.